This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard.
There's been a big emphasis on financial planning and financial literacy in recent years here in Wisconsin and around the country. People are encouraged to save for retirement, for education expenses, and for financial emergencies like the loss of a job.
But those kinds of savings can be hard to build up for people living on lower incomes, where day-to-day expenses and monthly bills take priority over savings, and unexpected costs like car repair or healthcare expenses can lead to financial crisis.
J. Michael Collins joins us now to talk about emergency savings for low-income people. He's Associate Professor of Public Affairs and Consumer Science at the UW-Madison, where he directs the Center for Financial Security. He's the editor of the book, A Fragile Balance, Emergency Savings and Liquid Resources for low-income consumers. Michael, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, as a society, Michael, and as policymakers maybe, have we paid much attention to this issue of emergency savings for people living on low income?
You know, we hear an awful lot about savings for retirement, savings for a house, savings for lots of things, but not much attention on this issue of unrestricted savings for an emergency, for a healthcare expense, for a loss of income.
So to the extent we have data, how many low-income people have reasonable emergency financial cushions available to them?
Well, the truth is even among middle-income people, there's a scarcity of these cushions. So it's about a third of low-income people who are saving for an emergency. About half of us overall are saving for an emergency, so it's lower than the average. The problem is most of us, when you ask how much do you need, we only have about half of what we think we need. So everyone's sort of struggling in this area, but it's even harder when you're low-income.
Yeah, at a low-income level, again, you're probably living day-to-day, month-to-month in a lot of ways. So what are the consequences for people in that situation and not having any or enough of that financial cushion?
Well, there's two problems that come up. One is you have a drop in income, like you didn't get the hours that you thought you might get, or you don't get the overtime. The other is you have an expense that you weren't prepared for. And those expenses sometimes aren't things you can put off. It might be rent, or it might be the car that you need to get to work. And so you end up borrowing. Sometimes you borrow from friends and family. Sometimes you borrow it at high cost. And in some cases, we see people who overdraft or they get into other kinds of trouble.
Right. It's kind of emergency management. So a payday lender, possibly, or I think in your book, you mentioned one way of managing is to put off bills, which can result in high fees, high penalties. So it's very costly to be poor.
It is.
In this situation.
And the truth is, sometimes even the savings accounts are expensive because there's a minimum balance, there's a monthly fee. And so if you don't keep enough in these accounts, you don't use them regularly, those can be expensive to maintain too.
So to what extent is this an issue of financial literacy, people not saving, I guess, in a nutshell, as opposed to people not having enough resources to save money in the first place?
It's a little bit of both, but when you talk to folks, if you ask them about what their financial goals are, a number one goal is always being prepared for an emergency. People want to be independent and they want to be resilient. And so this is one that people know they need to do, and they either can't because they don't have the resources or because it's hard to come up with an account that works for them.
Right. So to the extent that people in low-income situations have this, I mean, you mentioned a bank account might have fees that make it impossible or hard to do this. People, I guess, just saving cash around the house is a possibility?
Cash is a possibility, and it's also, we find a lot of informal networks. So it's my family. When I'm in trouble, I'll borrow from other people in my family. When they're in trouble, they borrow from me, and sort of we find these informal ways to help each other out.
And at these income levels, I want to kind of hammer this home, emergency, you know, might be something that's an inconvenience to someone else. Oh, I've got to pay to get my car fixed. That's a bummer. But if you can't pay for that, not only can you not get the car fixed, the car is the way you get to work. It's a snowball effect.
It's a snowball effect. And so, you know, whereas we might have a credit card or some other way to make these things work, for some families, it's a tough choice between, you know, rent or food or a car repair. And so sometimes that's a tough choice that has to be made.
Talking about emergency savings for low-income people, we have J. Michael Collins with us. He's the editor of the book, A Fragile Balance, and he's with the UW-Madison. So let's talk about what could be done about this. First, let's start with the financial literacy side of things. What kind of help might there be to help low-income people come up with a plan to save those resources for a financial emergency?
Yeah, and the truth is most people know that these emergencies can happen. They just are overly optimistic about they're not going to happen tomorrow. And they could happen tomorrow. And so part of this is just helping people become more realistic about what an emergency costs and that it could happen and what are they going to do in those kinds of cases. So it's a little bit of planning ahead. It doesn't take a whole lot of effort for people to think about this, but it's not something we want to think about because these are bad events, and so we don't want to think about that. The next is to try to come up with an account that works for them. And like you said, it might be a bank account or it might be something else, but trying to find a way that we can put money aside in a way that is efficient is a key.
Now, your book consists of some laying out the basic problem and then a lot of different policy suggestions, personal suggestions from a lot of different people, actually. And I want to get into some of those now. First of all, let's talk about access to some kind of financial vehicle that doesn't have prohibitive fees, that is accessible, that is liquid, I guess is the word, that people can access those resources when they need them. What kind of things could be helpful, maybe at a federal level, or that financial institutions or communities could offer?
You know, some financial institutions are aware of the fact that they need these basic accounts, and so they come up with an account with barely any fees or very, very low fees, and they're pretty accessible. The trouble is that they're not well known, and so people don't know that those accounts exist. There are some exciting things happening at the federal level, like there's this new MyRA product that has become available to the U.S. Treasury. It's designed to save for retirement, but there's no penalty from withdrawing early. So if you need that money, that could be a liquid source of resources as well.
Now, high-interest lenders, payday lenders, auto title loans, things like that, a lot of controversy in Wisconsin and everywhere else for that matter over the years. But one common defense for them is, if you take that away, that's it. There's no other credit alternative out there except, I've heard people say, except you know, a loan shark in your neighborhood or something like that. So could we kind of move past that controversy if there are better, less expensive vehicles for savings?
Yeah, and we talk about that a little bit in the book, too. We have some practitioners who've experimented with small-dollar loans, and they try to come up with a loan that they could charge an interest rate that's a little bit more reasonable. They are risky loans, but less than you might see from a high-cost payday lender. And they've had reasonably good success. The problem is getting them marketed. You know, we don't have that sort of infrastructure to get a product like this out to scale.
Well, from a policy perspective, and I think you mentioned this in the book, you need not just something that's going to work for people, something that people also can find, and something that financial institutions of one sort or another are going to buy into and actually want to do and want to provide and publicize to the people who need them.
That's right. And I'm sympathetic for financial institutions because these small accounts can be expensive to run. People might need a lot of help. They might actually bring negative balance, and so they could be expensive. And so finding a way for institutions to do this in a safe place, and that's a combination of policy and regulation, so that they can do some experimentation and they can try to come up with a business model that works for them.
So that's banks and credit unions. You also look into the ideas, different possible approaches from tax incentive perspectives, credits, deductions, maybe not so useful. Can you lay out what's out there?
Yeah, I mean, the truth is we have a lot of tax incentives for people to save for retirement, for a house, for education, and almost nothing for unrestricted savings that could actually help people avoid hardships in the long run. So trying to figure out more ways to provide incentives for these, you know, relatively small accounts, maybe up to $1,000 or $1,500 that people could put aside and get some sort of tax benefit from. That could be in the form of a tax credit. That's been an experiment that's floated by policymakers for a while for a small dollar tax credit for some amount of savings. And in fact, the most recent budget that was put out by OMB in the White House this week in the State of the Union included an emergency assistance provision. So it's an idea that's got a little bit of purchase now at the federal level.
Really? I didn't know that. I should have read the State of the Union a little more closely.
It was actually quite buried.
They buried that one.
It got picked up just a couple of resources. But it was a relatively like $2 billion set aside to try to do some experiments around emergency assistance.
Another thing you're hoping for in the book is that, okay, some things could happen at the federal level, but communities could really take the lead on something like this. So what kind of things are happening? Are there places that are tackling this problem?
It actually is an exciting field because most of the energy and enthusiasm is at the local level. Mm-hmm. It's local and city and partnerships between nonprofits and credit unions or financial institutions at the local level that's doing a lot of the exciting work. You know, example we have in the book is a organization that provides housing for low-income people. And they're essentially holding back $10 or $15 of every rent check to go into an escrow account so that if an emergency comes up, that family will have built up over the course of a couple of years several hundred dollars that they can use in case that happens. So there's lots of examples like that we have in the book of these partnerships that have developed that actually show some real promise.
So they might be working, there might be excitement at a local level, but that just helps that local level. Are there things you see out there that are promising that could be scaled, that could be lent to another community that could work in places other than the place it was born?
I think so. I think, you know, the key is to try to come up with more of these programs that can be integrated into a common program. So, you know, we have food assistance in most states. We have healthcare assistance in most states. We have other kinds of programs. And to try to marry these into those programs as much as we can. Housing is a great example. And obviously, many of our lenders today are regional or national in scope. And so to the extent we can create these kind of partnerships with financial institutions, they really could take them to a broader scale.
As we wrap up, you came out with this book over the last year. You've been working on these issues for longer than that. Do you see people, policymakers, community leaders, starting to pay more attention to this issue of emergency savings for low-income consumers?
Especially in the last year, I think we've really started to see more and more of that, because we know that one of the things that keeps people out of really not just poverty but real hardship of losing a house or of a real cutback is having this cushion in place. And so it's a tough issue to tackle from a federal level, but certainly we know that this is the kind of thing that can help people's finances be better off.
Michael, thanks a lot for joining us.
Appreciate it.
That was J. Michael Collins. He's director of the Center for Financial Security at UW-Madison. He's editor of the book, A Fragile Balance, Emergency Savings and Liquid Resources for Low-Income Consumers.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.